And now it's time for Stages.
Stages.
All the world's a stage.
It's where we talk about,
it's about all things
theatrical.
It's about theatre.
Theatre makers.
If it's performing on a stage, we've got it for you here on Stages.
It's about half an hour long.
Okay, let's get on with the show.
Good evening and welcome to Stages. I'm Regina Botros and we are talking theatre. And this evening's guest is part of the Sydney Comedy Festival. Yes, it's kicking off at the end of the month and it's going ahead so far. Touch wood. The first gala, there are a number of galas, is on Monday the 19th of April at the State Theatre. There are a couple of other galas as well, but one of the shows that we are talking about this evening is an individual show that's on. It's on at Manning House at the University of Sydney, and it's previewing from the 22nd of April, and it's running from the 24th of April to the Sunday the 16th of May, so it's got quite a run, and it's called Chappelle Chappelle. I can't help but think of Rochelle Rochelle. It must have something to do with it. I'm looking forward to finding out about that. It's looking at Chappelle Corby. What a great idea. And Australia's weakness for media sensationalism is told through the life of her, Chappelle, on her arrest. Now, we're going back to Bali, 2005, so I'm sure to be a fun interview where I'm talking with Abby Galloway, who is the director, producer, and co-writer on that production. So stick around. A strange erotic trip, the Chappelle Corby story told through a musical. What a hoot. The other thing that is coming up is a return of A Room of One's Own. So I'm going to take this opportunity a little later on in the show to play a bit of my interview with the absolutely wonderful Anita Hegg. I spoke with her in October last year, so you'll get a sense of the space without too many people in it. But we are so lucky, and I didn't get to see it then, so I hope with crossed fingers and toes that I get to see it this time round at Belvoir Street. So stick around. Also, later on in the show, Anita Hegg will be joining me with that classic, A Room of One's Own, returned almost verbatim, I think, from memory to the stage at Belvoir Theatre. So much to talk about. Well, I'm going to play you some Jude Pearl. She's also performing at the Sydney Comedy Festival, and she is a winner of 3 Green Room Awards for Best Original Songs 2016, 17 and 18, Best Cabaret Melbourne Fringe 2018, and winner of Green Room Award for Cabaret Artiste 2019. Here's her singing Hamish.
We're in the same English class in 2006, and you would draw pictures of girls' asses, and that's when I knew that you liked girls' asses. You sat there in your plain white t-shirt between Tim and Susan, and I could see your nipples through your t-shirt. I'm only human, how can I resist you? Hamish, oh Hamish McMahon, the way that you sit in that chair. Hamish, ooh, your pants were low, I could see your turquoise underwear. Hamish, I'm falling for you and your vain attempts at facial hair.
Well, that was Jude Pearl. She's also performing at the Sydney Comedy Festival at the Factory Theatre on the 15th and 16th of May. Well, you're listening to Stages, and my guest this evening is Abby Galloway. She is a director, actor, writer, producer, and stage manager. She's acted in a number of productions, and she's bringing her show, Chappelle Chappelle, to the Sydney Comedy Festival, which is opening at the end of the month. I can't wait to see this show. What a title. I mean, Chappelle Corby. But before we get into that, let's welcome Abby Galloway.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. We will. Look, let's just jump in now. Chappelle, you know what I can't help but think of? Chappelle Corby, I know, but Rochelle from Seinfeld.
Yeah.
As well. Is that intentional?
Yeah, that is. Well, that's, you know, that's the origin of the show. We were laughing about that reoccurring gag in Seinfeld. You know, it's the erotic novel turned erotic film turned erotic musical. And we were joking about that. And then one of the writers just kind of said, Chappelle, oh, that would make a good musical. And history, you know?
It's what a, like, I always say, you know, everything's being turned into a musical these days, but I would never have expected this to be one of them. So, you know, what are you working with? Obviously, life events, the things that happened. How are you kind of shaping it? What's the story?
Yeah, the narrative is really shaped by the media circus around her life. And that's the lens in which we really look at the whole story through. So we do explore, you know, Chappelle's emotional arc and her family's journey, but we're also exploring, like, what the, you know, what the media's lens and purpose and is in society, and how that can sometimes function as a force of destruction.
Is it sort of like through humour you were pointing out?
Oh, absolutely. Like, when I explain it like that, it sounds like very serious. But we use comedy, you know, as a tool to explore the, you know, these serious themes. And I think that's, you know, that's dark comedy in a nutshell. You know, you make them laugh, make them cry.
So are you acting in it as well? Because you were director, writer, producer, like all these many hats.
No, I don't have the greatest voice or dancing skills, but directing it has been an incredible experience. You know, I learn something new each day, and I find it's really pushed my, it's really pushed me as a director doing this show.
So is it a little bit Seinfeld meets Chicago?
Yeah, there's a quirkiness to the humour. There's an irreverence, which definitely, you know, inspired by Seinfeld. But there's also, it's really exciting getting to play around with these larrikin characters in musical format, because we don't get a lot of that here. We have a lot of fantastic imported musicals, but, you know, we don't have producers putting the money into our own homegrown musicals.
So is it all happening, I suppose what I mean by Chicago, is it all happening in a prison? Is it that sort of setting, or are we kind of following her, or we have the media as well, obviously, like you say?
So. Yeah, we meet her, you know, in Queensland before she flies, and then, yeah, she is in prison for a lot of the musical, but because we're jumping between her and media segments with the family and with each other, it doesn't feel like you're stuck in prison for too long. And also we explore her relationship with Renee Lawrence as well. So there's a lot of variations in location.
And choreography.
Yes, yeah.
What fun.
I think the choreography is really, we use it as a tool for humour majority of the time, and we wanted the choreography to feel authentic to the Corbys, you know, like what would they put together if they had to do a musical, is sort of our vision. the curry is great.
Is this a first for you, kind of musical side? Like, I know you've acted, but is this sort of a new place for you to explore?
Yeah, absolutely. I've never worked on a musical before, but I grew up listening to a lot of musical theatre, a lot of Broadway sort of musical theatre. So the music's in my bones, and the understanding of how a musical should feel and the shape of it is buried deep inside me. And it's been really exciting getting to sort of utilize that and have that come out in ways I didn't expect.
So is it all spoken through music, or is there dialogue or text as well?
Yeah, well, there's actually quite a lot of scene work. And I think that works better, especially in like the, you know, Australian cultural sort of format. It really works having these sort of big scenes that really lead up to the song quite nicely. And that's also like, you know, where you fit a lot of the humour in and the characterisation, and yeah, it balances out the show.
So you say you grew up watching musicals. How did your interest, you know, in theatre start? Did you come from a creative family? Like, what was the beginnings like?
I come from a family of failed actors. No, that's so rude. My family are wonderful performers, and it's always sort of been in my bones. And I was lucky enough to go to Newtown High School of Performing Arts, and that was an incredible environment where we were really nurtured and also pushed to sort of hone in on those crafts. And and then I went and did the theatre media course at Charles Sturt University, and that's where I met the guys, and we put this on as a major work. And I feel very privileged to have had the theatrical journey that I have had.
You've done a bit of stage managing as well. Tell me some of the things that you've seen and what you kind of learn from working on that side of the stage.
Yeah, I think I really love stage managing. I'm not sure if I'm very good at it. I think the best stage managers I've met are the ones that being organized is like intrinsically a part of who they are as a person, whereas I have to try hard. But it's such an amazing opportunity to observe the director working with the actor and how they work with the rest of the crew. You pick up so many little nuances in how a production is made. I had the good fortune to be deputy stage manager on The Dismissal at the Seymour Centre, and that was so eye-opening and educational for me to then go on and do, I think it was our second run of Chappelle. I came back to the show with such a broad understanding of what a professional production is.
So what did you observe?
Be organized.
But in terms of watching the relationships within the director and actors as well, is it that? Or
I think, you know, what I really observe, you know, from J. James Moody, who's an incredible director, is how much he trusts the actors and allows them to play within the space, and how he really carefully shapes his vision of the show. But he had such a relaxed air about him as well. And I think, you know, a lot of directing is about facilitating an atmosphere for creation, and he did that really well. So that was really, really cool to see and pick up on.
And it sounds like that the essence of working with the actors in giving them a voice, I was going to say, but you know what I mean? Like they have input and they are able to realize the show as well.
Absolutely. And I find actors often sometimes know what the scene needs better than myself outside, because they're in it, they can really feel it. And on this show especially, because we're all at, you know, the early stages of our career, we're all still learning. And, you know, as a director, I'm able to lean on the cast with, you know, their choreography. And you know Kelsey, who plays Chappelle, is an amazing vocalist, and we lean on her as well. It's truly like the most collaborative experience, and no one's precious either, which makes everything easy.
It sounds like a lot of fun. Where are you playing at?
Yeah, so we're playing at Manning House in Sydney Uni, which is really exciting because traditionally it's this really well-established live music venue. That's spanned across generations. And obviously because of COVID, they're looking for things where people can sit down. So it's really exciting to play in, you know, a different space and a space that's known for music as well. The sound quality will be mind-blowing. So we're really, really excited and so honoured to be a part of Sydney Comedy Festival. It's just a great, great festival.
And you wear many hats, and that's sort of part of the job lot, I suppose, of being in the stage, in the theatre industry, at least initially. Like you say, you've acted, directing, producing, writing, now writing, you know, musical choreography. Is there something that you particularly, you know, is the one that you want to do?
It's hard. I think I've definitely fallen in love with directing, absolutely. And I do love to write. I don't like writing alone. I'm a very writer room collaborative person. And yeah, and I do love acting, but it also scares the hell out of me. So I've kind of not been doing much acting while I've been focused on directing and writing and producing and all of that. But yeah, I think directing's stolen my heart.
Well, Abby Galloway, thank you so much for joining me. I can't wait to see Chappelle. Did you work on, like, did you watch lots of episodes of Seinfeld as part of the workshopping just before we go? Was that sort of the, you know?
Myself and one of the other lead writers grew up on it. So it's one of those things that's just in you. I mean, and the show's genius, and their consistency and the fact that each episode feels like a mini play as well. It's just got that arc, and the timing just feels like it could be made for the stage. So,
wow. I see a whole new show for next year. Seinfeld, the musical. Oh, well, Abby Galloway, thank you so much for joining me again.
Thanks for having me, Regina.
To SER wishes to acknowledge the custodians of the land from which we broadcast, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and the Wadumatagal clan of the Darug Nation, and their elders past, present and emerging. We acknowledge and respect their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of this city and this region.
As I said, last year in October, I spoke with the just gorgeous Anita Hegg, an absolute legendary performer of our times, about her experience in A Room of One's Own, the Virginia Woolf classic, which was brought to the stage at Belvoir then, and it is returning to the stage, which I am so thankful for because I didn't get a chance to see it the first time. Here's a little bit of Anita talking about the production.
if we did the whole essay in its entirety on stage, it would be about 6.5, 7 hours probably. Yeah. But what Tom Wright and Carissa Licciardello have done is distilled it, really. So it still has these 6 chapters, but they've been condensed and truncated into something that people can consume in an hour and 20 minutes. So it's still very dense. There's still a lot to absorb in that time. But okay. I think the way that they've crafted it is really quite brilliant. And there's also a design element in our production, which really helps those ideas pop. And it's been such a joy to do. But yes, I there are so many parallels with today. She wrote this in 1928, around about 1928. And now we're still thinking, yeah, there's a lot there that hasn't changed.
Right. How so? Like what?
Well, probably, you know, for women, things like equal pay, equal respect, all those sorts of things. She talks about how a woman needs material things to, or any kind of artist needs intellectual freedom. And to have intellectual freedom, you need material things. So you have to, you can't be spending your days worried about how do I keep this roof over my head? How do I feed my children? How do I, or, you know, all these sorts of things. It just gives you no room to dream or to work artistically if your life is consumed with those things. So she kind of goes back in history and says, well, the very first female writers were ladies, you know, they were of nobility. They weren't the common person.
They were supported, basically.
That's right. And then from the 16th century, we go through and we look at, okay, so when the middle class woman started writing, she wrote novels. She wasn't in a room, her own study, where she had all the reference books out and, you know, her complete works of Shakespeare or anything like that. She was hiding and scribbling her novel in a corner and hoping that no one would interrupt her or come in. So she sort of looks at, you know, that kind of 18th century, you know, flow of those novels, like, you know, the Jane Austens and the Charlotte Brontes and all those people. And then she kind of looks at where she's at and goes, well, okay, so I'm not consumed with anger and bitterness about the fact that I don't have the freedom to write in the way that men do, like these former female writers have, the women before me. But there is still that element. And she kind of lands with the idea that in about 100 years' time, which for us is about 8 years from now, conditions will be right for women in which she will be able to write with the equal conditions that men have in terms of environment, pay, all those other social conditions. So it's quite an extraordinary thought journey that she takes us through history and looking to this woman of the future. So she says that this woman will be born, this female Shakespeare, whoever she'll be, will be born. But we all have to work towards that. We all have to work towards having, you know, 500 a year and a room of her own.
Reading it, it is such an internal thought and feeling. How is that transformed to stage?
Actually verbatim. So I literally have truncated the her essay word for word. So they've just kind of picked out the gems or the threads that they think will work and weave together. So no, Ella is in a space of her own. We're both in rooms of our own.
Love it.
Yeah, so she's part of this visual landscape that supports the story, Virginia's words.
So how is it now on the stage? And how do you kind of carry the energy that maybe was it easier when there's more people? How is it going?
Yeah, we started off with about a third capacity. So it was like about 110, 115. Yeah. And then some people were still maybe a little bit nervous about coming along. So sometimes we just have, you know, maybe 90 or 100 people.
Yeah.
And that went really, really well, but it did feel a little empty. You know, it did feel a little empty. But it's kind of a direct address to the audience.
Yeah.
It sort of worked in that way. Like, it's not a raucous comedy, right? So you don't need, like, we're not waiting for the big belly laughs or anything like that. The piece still worked in that way. But now that we've got half capacity, so that's like an extra 30 people maybe, you really feel the richness and fullness of the auditorium all of a sudden. Like, you really feel like people are there and they're really present and they're much more vocal. So it's been really fantastic. I think the show's really hit its stride in the last week or two because, I mean, really, this is the thing. This is what theatre's about. It is an exchange between performer and audience. So I really feel them out there and I feel supported and that feeds into my work. And so it's been a real reminder of that and a real lesson in how we it's a conversation.
So you've done so many productions over the years. Is there a particular one that sits for you as like significant and or proud of or something that was most challenging? Or like, I mean, you've done so many, so it's probably hard to choose.
I think that you remember things from your youth a lot more. Mm-hmm. And I think probably when I did Rosalind in As You Like It, Simon Phillips directed it back in 1996 or 98 or something like that.
Yeah.
So, and that was at the Drama Theatre in the Opera House. And I remember thinking, wow, here I am in the Sydney Theatre Company playing this role. And I'm not sure I was particularly very good, but I know Carrie Bedell was great. She was singing. It was kind of like a jazz version of the play. It was really wonderful. They had a fantastic score of music that she sang. But I really felt like, wow, okay, this is what I've always wanted. You know, this is the dream. So that was probably, you know, I think I was 23, 24 then. So that was quite a significant moment for me. And there have been little things along the way. Like I remember I worked with Peter Evans on a show called Yellow Wallpaper, which was another one-person show. And that was like a really special thing because that was kind of the first kind of thing I felt like I had creative input into in terms of how the work was developed. So that was a really special thing. And then working with Benedict Andrews on the Martin Crimp play, The City, Gross and Klein, that starred Cate Blanchett, and we got to go on tour with that. We got to go to Paris and London and Vienna.
Wow.
That was really exciting. Things like that. Working with Kit Williams recently on Arturo Uy, Harp in the South. They've been really, amazing.
So how do you prepare? Do you have like a ritual that you go through? Like how do you maintain the kind of, I don't know, stamina, I suppose?
Yeah, so when we started rehearsal, we had about a week in the room at Belfast Street, and then we had to stop. I had a four-month-old, and I had about half a script in my head, I think, about half of it by that stage because I started writing it last Christmas. Yeah, no, I thought, with a baby, I thought I've got to get onto this early. And Chris was fantastic. She, you know, we'd Zoom and keep working on the script together and work on the lines together. So that was really great. And then, you know, we'd go back and we'd have another 2 weeks and we had to stop. And, you know, so it was kind of sporadic over a 5-6 month period. But I think there was a real benefit because that work was just sort of swimming around in my brain, even though I wasn't looking at it every day or, you know, I'd done that work. Sometimes I look back and go, wow, would I have made it? I probably needed to have the whole thing in my head learnt, you know, if we hadn't had to stop. And I think maybe we would have just been watching an actor standing on stage just trying to remember their lines. You know, I don't know if I would have been able to inhabit it as well as, you know, we've been able to. So, you know, that having that amount of time and space has had some benefits, as well as, you know, of course, the disruptions have been difficult too, particularly for the designers and the creatives. So, yeah, it's been very, very tricky. But in terms of preparation now, I really do feel like it's in me. When my warm-up is I go on stage and I go through bits of each section just to kind of and remind myself where I'm going with it, because it is a very complicated thought journey and you have to really be conscious of where you're directing it, or else I think you can confuse people. The idea is to try and keep the ideas as clear and of the utmost importance, you know, it's about the ideas and you can't, if you start muddying it, you can lose people, I think. So I just have to really be conscious of where I'm going with it. Objectives. There you go. Actions and objectives. Those sorts of things. So I've you know, it's just a little process of that, and then a little bit of a vocal warm up and away we go. It's a real joy to do, because it's so funny. Virginia Woolf talks about Coleridge in this, and she says this wonderful thing about Coleridge. She says, when one takes a sentence of Coleridge into the mind, it explodes and gives birth to all kinds of other ideas, and that is the only sort of writing of which one can say that it has the secret of perpetual life. And that's how I feel about Virginia's work. So when I'm on stage saying these words, I'm going, I don't think I could ever get sick of saying these, because they're so deep and they're so rich and there's so much in them, and they make you think about other things all the time. And It's really extraordinary privilege to be able to work with this text.
Well, that's it from me. I'm Regina Botros. Thanks to my guest this evening, Abby Galloway, with her show Chappelle, which is coming up as part of the festival, and also my repeat of Anita Hegg with A Room of One's Own. Such a lovely production also. So I can't wait for that. I'll see you next week. Well, you may hear me next week on Stages, talking about theatre and all things theatrical. Can't wait. See you then.